Welcome to Sunset Gita. And today we're reading Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, verse 21. So forgive me, I have a bit of a cold, but I think we can still do a responsive chanting of the verse here. And then again, the topic is really exciting. I was actually really looking forward to this today. The topic of multiple realities that we can actually... If I was going to be facetious about it, I would say that we can be rational creatures and also Krishna devotees. If I was going to be a little less facetious about it, I would say that we can live both on a plane that makes logical sense, the world we can perceive, and then simultaneously dwell on levels of reality that are utterly invisible and which operate in ways that defy logic and rational thought. And how those things can fit together is a tremendously exciting journey. So we're going to get to that. So let's start by chanting this verse, the 21st verse of chapter 4. We'll do it line by line responsively. So here's how this sounds. This isn't the verse we did last time.
No,
we're 21. Okay. So actually, we should start with the invocation. Would you repeat after me? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate.
Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, text 21. Nirashiryata chittatma. You try that.
Nirashiryata chittatma.
Chaktva sarva parigraha.
Chakva sarva parigraha.
Shariram kevalam karma.
Shariram kevalam karma.
Kurvan apnoti kilvisham.
Kurvan apnoti kilvisham.
Nirashiratta chittatma.
Nirashiryata chittatma.
Jaktva sarva parigraha.
Jaktva sarva parigraha.
Shariram kevalam karma.
Shariram kevalam karma.
Kurvan apnoti kilvisham.
Kurvan apnoti kilvisham.
Like to try? Brave hearts. All right, Nick, you're up.
Nirashiryata
chittatma.
Takcha sarva parigraha.
Chakta sarva parigraha.
Sirima.
Shariram.
Shariram kevalam karma.
Shariram kevalam
karma.
Kurvanapnoti kilbisham. Most of the verses follow a similar kind of cadence. So one or two melodies like this one, and you can pretty much get through the whole Gita. Translation of this 21st verse. Such a man of understanding acts with mind and intelligence perfectly controlled, gives up all sense of proprietorship over his possessions, and acts only for the bare necessities of life. Thus working, he is not affected by sinful reactions. Now, first of all, such a man, who are we talking about here? If you go back a couple of verses to text 18, one who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is intelligent among men and is in the transcendental position, although engaged in all sorts of activities. And then the next verse, one is understood to be in full knowledge, whose every endeavor is devoid of desire for sense gratification. He is called a worker for whom reactions of work have been burned up in the fire of perfect knowledge. So there's a description of a kind of spiritual character, if you will, behavior pattern, that is the definer for such a man of understanding. And the ostensible impression here, if you take these verses on face value, the impression is that it's rather austere. This is a depiction of someone who might almost be described as indifferent to things, which is why the Bhagavad Gita really needs to be discussed, not studied in a vacuum. The verses on their own are little sutras. A sutra is a code. It's a lot of information condensed down into very few words. That needs to be unpacked. And every word in Sanskrit can mean 10 different things. So the verses on their own have a lot of depth and meaning. Then if you take that verse in the context of the point that's being made, let's say within the chapter, it takes on yet more significance and additional significance. Now take that chapter in the context of the story of this raging battle that's about to begin. And you have even a greater context. Take that battle, put it within the context of the Mahabharata, which is the epic narrative, known as the Itihasa, from which the Bhagavad Gita emerges, and you have yet another dimension of meaning. So the only way to really understand the Bhagavad Gita is, as we're doing it here, as a discussion. It gives us a chance to share our various realizations. It gives us a chance to air concerns, confusions, uncertainties, whatever it may be. So this is critical. This is critical. And as austere as the depiction may be of someone in knowledge, in spiritual knowledge, that emerges from these verses, look at who it is Krishna's talking. First of all, Krishna himself is a king. So he lives in opulence. Right? He lives in a rather privileged environment, as does Arjuna. Arjuna is also royalty. He's born into a royal family. He doesn't lack for anything. So, you know, this is a talk about living an austere, detached life among people who live in an unaustere and rather full environment. So clearly the indication here is not that in order to become spiritually awakened, you have to physically move away from the things of this world. It's rather quite the opposite. Stay where you are. That's the whole message of the Gita. Arjuna wanted to move away. He wanted to go away from everything. He wanted to give up his royal position. He wanted to give up being a soldier. He basically wanted to quit his job and run away. And Krishna's point to him is, no, stay here. You'll find the very thing that you're looking for inside the context of the life you have. You do not need to covet a life that you do not have in order to reach the fulfillment, the fullness of your being. In fact, if you leave the life that you have thinking that you're going to find greater fulfillment in some other environment, what is it that you've taken with you into that new environment? What have you brought with you? You walk away from a problem.
Yourself.
You brought yourself. And yourself is someone who's unhappy with things. So what are you taking with you? You're taking yourself and your discontent. And will that discontent not also follow you into your new situation, whatever that might be? Now, again, because these verses have multiple layers of meaning, and that's where we're going here, is to talk about multiple layers of meaning and reality. This does not mean that if you are in an abusive relationship, that you should stay there and find God. If you're in an abusive relationship, get out. Move away from a harmful situation. That's common sense. There's nothing spiritual about thinking you're a martyr. You know, like, oh, well, God put me here. These circumstances are meant to purify me. I'm supposed to learn something. You know, those are rather feeble justifications for often avoiding something that might subconsciously appear even more difficult than staying with the problematic environment you're in. Okay? Why is it that so many people stay in harmful situations? Are any of you dealing with older people? Aging parents? You're comfortable with the environment you know. It's familiar. My aches and pains are familiar, so that's what I relate to. Strange things. We're humans. We're very strange creatures. You know. Yeah.
I always think it's a lot of work to change your life. Hard.
It's very hard work. Very hard work.
And it's lonely. I mean, like, it's a lonely path. To be like, I'm living this one life that's very, wake up, go to work, come home, watch TV, go to bed. I'm not happy with who I am, but I'm just going through this life. When does the weekend start? I can like play around golf. This seems like
the Sanskrit to describe that situation is boga tyaga. Boga means enjoying, and tyaga means giving up. So you enjoy, and then you get fed up with it, and you're tired of it, and it's not doing anything for you. So you tyaga, you renounce it. And then renunciation doesn't satisfy you for very long, so you again come back to whatever it was that you had before, even if it was not really fulfilling. So boga and tyaga, enjoying, renouncing, you go back and forth, without really addressing the underlying issue of why am I stuck in this pattern? What is it? And sometimes it's something as simple as the pattern is familiar. I would rather live with the discomfort and the dysfunctionality of this environment because I don't know what's going to happen to me when I get out there. If I move away from this, what's my life going to be like? And that uncertainty can be terrifying, utterly terrifying. So, it's moving into that uncertain territory that I'd like us to talk about here. And I really, once again, have to thank my brother Brian for his descriptions of the world of physics, the cutting edge of physics, for helping me find some examples that I can share with you to talk about this phenomenal mystery of how it's possible for us to live on multiple levels of reality simultaneously. The world we know and worlds we cannot even imagine, and somehow make it all fit into one life. Okay, so, ready? All right, here we go. The first thing that I'd like to tell you about is probably the single most famous experiment in the history of physics. It's called the double slit experiment. Has anyone heard of it?
We talked about it.
Did we talk about the double slit experiment? See, I got a cold. I don't remember anything. I don't know what we talked about. How many of you were not here when we talked about the double slit experiment? Okay, so it's worth repeating, very much so. And then we'll talk about something you haven't heard of. The double slit experiment essentially shows that a beam of light can act sometimes as particles and at other times like waves. undulating waves. If you take a plank of wood and cut a slit in it, and then take a particle shotgun and fire particles at that slit, on the wall behind the slit, you will find what you expect, namely a vertical column, a pattern of those particles where they made their way through that slit. If you were to then cut a second slit in that same plank of wood and fire particles at that two slits, what would you expect to happen on the wall behind that plank of wood?
They would collect two.
Yeah, you'd expect to find two columns of particles where they're all stuck. Imagine, for example, taking golf balls out of a golf ball shooter and, you know, a big slit in a piece of wood, and you fire golf balls against a wall of clay. Well, you'd expect to see a strip of golf balls going up and down, right? So normally, if you had two such slits, you'd expect that wall of clay behind them to accumulate two such strips of golf balls. When you go down to the level of particles, however, something quite different and quite extraordinary happens. Instead of these two discrete lines, what you have is a spectrum of dark and light spaces. What is that dark and light panoply that appears when you shoot particles through two parallel slits? Well, imagine if you have, instead of particles, a tank of water, and you to agitate that water. Now, you've done this in the bathtub, you've done this when you've gone swimming. You've seen how waves in water emanate outward. Now, if two waves intersect, at a certain point, the tops of these waves will meet and they'll cancel each other out. And in other places, the troughs of the waves will meet and they'll cancel themselves out as well. So that the pattern that's established when you have waves of water going through slits is this kind of dark white pattern on the wall behind that border with the slits in it. That's the pattern that you get when particles are shot simultaneously through two slits. Not discrete little points of reality, but this rather unpredictable wave. Now, how is it possible for light to simultaneously be a discrete point of a particle and at the same time act like a smooth wave? That's two very, very different behavior patterns from the same phenomenon. Not only that, but check this out. It turns out that you can't predict which way light is going to behave. We don't know when light emanates from a source whether it's going to behave like particles, discrete points, or like wave functions. When you posit an observer or a camera or some kind of way of recording what's going on, that collapses the possibilities. So that, and this is going to sound a little weird, so just bear with me here. If you're looking for particles, you're going to find particles. If you're looking for waves, you find waves. Now, that sounds very weird. It sounds science fiction-y. How is it possible that just by the intent of observing light and wanting to see particles, discrete points, that's what occurs? And in other circumstances, the intent of finding that smooth wave function seems to somehow actuate the wave function option in a beam of light. It's one of the most bizarre and bewildering experiments to ever have taken place in the history of physics. Now, I may not be explaining it to you very eloquently because this is not my métier. Well, what I can tell you is that I've seen this. When Brian had his science festival this past June, he brought an actual particle gun up on stage and showed these two different results from the same beam of light. What it says is that there is some dimension of reality that escapes logical analysis. Now, I'm going to take this even a little bit further just to show you how really weird things get. There's something called spooky action at a distance. Now, as best I've understood, and this is just from the explanations that I've heard and things that I've read, it seems that in the world of subatomic particles, if two particles become what is known as entwined, two particles come within the vicinity of each other and therefore have a kind of relationship. I'm not exactly sure what kind of a relationship particles have. They've never invited me in to talk about it, but it happens. When two particles become entangled, and it's technically called quantum entanglement, it seems that they are then irrevocably entangled, even if they are separated by impossibly large distances. So that one particle that is now light years away from the other particle still has a relationship with that particle. And if you were to alter the spin, there's something called a spin. Particles have spin. It's actually up or down, even though it's sideways. It's called up or down. If you were to change the spin of one of those two particles from up to down, from going one direction to going in the other direction, which you can do by exposing it to certain influences, the partner particle mimics the behavior of that particle, even without any connection between them. There is no means of communication between these two particles. There is nothing happening between them, and the influence happens instantaneously. It doesn't even take time. It's as though they're one entity existing simultaneously in two bodies at vastly remote distances.
So that's what happens when you're chanting.
Well, we can get to that, whether that's what happens when we're chanting. It's not a bad poetic parallel.
And this is one thing that makes Einstein
crazy. It drove Einstein crazy. His famous statement to Niels Bohr was, "God doesn't play dice with the universe. There can't be these kinds of uncertainties in nature. There'll be a spin. Even if we can't calculate it, there'll be some explanation, even if we don't know what it is." To which Niels Bohr replied, "Albert, don't tell God what to do." Now, the reason I bring these two particular examples from physics into a discussion about multiple levels of reality and how we live on multiple levels of reality is that the currency of credibility is science. We may not like that. Science has proven itself to be a fallible ally many times and has disappointed us, and there is always new evidence, so conclusions are changing and being modified. But still, we live in a time when, if something has scientific validity, more than likely you're going to accept it. You don't know, I got a cold, okay? I talked to a pharmacist. The pharmacist said, "Okay, you know what? You want to knock this thing out? Take these two things and do it in this way." It was the prescription that went with it. Well, I'm not a chemist. I don't know what the chemical composition of these things is. But I trust this pharmacist. He's done the study. He's got the science behind it. So I accept it. I'm going to take it. Yeah.
I'm sorry, could you speak up just a little? No, I understand CPACs work quite well. No, I got. What did he recommend to me? Claritin. Yes. And vitamin C. A couple of those. Thanks for your concern. Point being that we're still, you know, and we particularly, we yogis, you know, we kind of go back and forth rather easily between the language of science, you know, CPACs and Claritin and whatever, and, you know, neti pots and, you know, different asanas and consciousness and atma and samsara, you know. We're somehow rather comfortable in these two different vocabularies, which are really very different. So there's already two worlds we live in that are vastly different from each other. But there are even much more complex and exciting realms of mystery to the universe and to the reality around us that we live in simultaneously. There was one lecture that Prabhupada gave when he described it, in a sense, the soul isn't even here. How's that for a mind blower? In a sense, we're not even here.
Actually, on June 6th, there was an experiment done, or a proof of Higgs boson.
Higgs boson, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. They say that mass is because of intentions.
Yeah, the discovery of the Higgs boson, which still needs to be verified, of course,
yeah,
could very much... could go a long way to validating what's known as the standard model, which has governed the field of physics for about the past 50 years or so. So there are these discoveries going on all the time. But here's the funny part. The more discoveries, the less simple things become. The more we discover, the more complicated and uncertain things become, the more mysterious things become. Which says that there is a dimension that we may never really understand about the universe we inhabit. Probably the height of hubris, which is the Greek word for the pride that brought down the wrath of the gods, probably the height of hubris is thinking that our tiny little intellect is capable of encompassing the vastness of creation. And that somehow we will find a formula by our own device that will bring all of that within some kind of realm of comprehension and ultimately mastery over nature. That's the part of science that I think we might want to approach with some caution when it starts to make claims like that. But if nothing else, what we're seeing is that there are dimensions of reality that are so far beyond what we understand. Now, what does that have to do with the Bhagavad Gita? So far, we've been dealing with chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, and even 5 and 6 coming up that are relatively approachable. You know, Krishna is talking about different kinds of yoga, talking about behavior, ways of interacting on the daily predictable levels. By the end of the sixth chapter, Arjuna will have recovered a sufficient amount of his self-confidence that he's going to be ready to step out of his comfort zone and go into areas that right now, in this early part of their discussion, he's not ready for. And that's where things start to get really wacky. Ultimately culminating in the 11th chapter, where he has this cosmic vision that is so terrifying that he could not bear to look at it. I remember when I joined the Krishna Temple in December of 1969 in London, how excited I felt by the good company that was there, by the wonderful vegetarian food that they were cooking there, by the sense of going out and doing some good in the world. Every time I looked at these posters of elephant-headed beings and four-armed goddesses and weird stuff. I kind of did a double take, and I was wondering, well, is it necessary for all of that stuff to be part of this? You know, does it have to get that far out in order for this stuff, which I can understand, to make sense? And what I discovered eventually over time was that there is as much substance and meaning in those, that kind of imagery, and a world which seems so mythological, so totally mythological, that it is as valuable toward my sense of how to move forward in daily life as these more logical, rational verses that talk about working with a sense of detachment. Seeing that not getting involved can have as much of a negative reaction as getting involved in the wrong way. That's the verse 18 that we read a few minutes ago. Those hidden realities have as much substance in my life as the realities that I can perceive. And how they have as much of impact is something that I'd like us to discuss together. So I'm going to shut up now. You had your hand up, Olga. What was on your mind? Science is an extension of the brain. I think that's true. If you also allow room for science to be an extension of the imagination.
Right, but then, you know, they have this empirical evidence why everything that you imagine you have to.
Right, well, science does posit certain parameters for itself,
right,
that it needs to be testable, it needs to be repeatable, and each time it's repeated, the same results need to occur, and then something can be described as scientifically valid. Right.
Otherwise, it's hypothesis. Otherwise, it's considered a hypothesis.
Otherwise, it's considered a hypothesis.
So, I was sort of thinking about this when I actually saw Brian and Charlie Rose, when he was describing some of the big stuff. And he was mentioning how they were smashing these subatomic particles together, creating this energy field, and that energy was going to be so great that they were actually going to chip off a piece of the energy field and materialize this energy and actually turn it to matter and chip off this little piece. And that was the Higgs particle. So, yeah, this energy, before the matter appears, this energy field may have been there before these material bodies that we have or created. There's this energy field. So, well, what's that energy field? That's like another reality. Maybe that energy field is some kind of source of God or Krishna or, you know, something like that.
Well, it's great mind game stuff, all of these, you know, parallels, you know, with scientific discovery. And it's all pretty marvelous. What I'm looking for, though, is to ground this discussion of multiple realities in the life that we live in a very pragmatic way. It's not very pragmatic sometimes, yes, that's quite true, it's not.
Sometimes what I do is just at the end of the day, I ask myself, what did you learn today? Because the only thing that's truly real for me, even though I allow myself to ponder on the laws of science as well as metaphysics and spiritualism, I can't give it full value until it shows up in my life sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I just ask myself at the end of the day, what did you learn? And then I can see how those components begin to come together and they have a similar expression.
We like that. We like when something proves itself practically, because we get comfort out of solving a problem. If a problem can be solved, we feel good that we've done something, we've resolved something, we can get on with the rest of our lives. Most of life, however, is not condensable, simplifiable down to such problems and solutions. Most of life is comprised of dilemmas that don't have simple solutions. The best thing you can do with the dilemma is hope for some positive forward movement, not necessarily a full resolution, which the big problems often don't have.
then I also admit, though, that I don't hold all the knowledge and intelligence necessary to be able to understand it all. But I also leave that door open to being willing to learn more throughout every day.
Okay, well, let's ground this in a practical example.
So the first thing that comes to mind is the way I pronounce different hats for the person. Yeah, right. Because I mean, when I'm around my friends, I'm a dirt
ball.
Well, I can be, and it's fun to be. I like to be, you know. But you know.
All right. So you have your dirt ball reality.
Yes, I'm not dirty. I mean, we say dirty things. We have the same, you know, people's class or something. You know, not dirty, just you know. I call it like my
this is getting bigger and bigger.
But you know, I mean, you put on these hats and. You know,
no, this is a good example. This is a very good example.
Sometimes I worry. I'm like, am I a two-faced guy? Am I, insincere?
Okay. Right. You've just put your finger on one of the biggest dilemmas of spiritual life, which is how can I remain true to this inner reality of myself as a spiritual being and also live these other external realities which other people perceive? To this person, I am their friend. To this person, I am their partner. To this person, I am a relative, a family member. To this person, I'm an employee or an associate or a colleague or whatever. To this other person over here, I'm something else. How do we reconcile those many different realities, both the visible and the invisible?
Well, I don't know. I mean, my justification is that, you know, we have roles to play. We have different services we have to provide. And then to effectively provide a service, it has to come with a kind of a hat or a badge or a uniform. And we have to change those uniforms.
Well, let me rephrase the question. What would make living any of those external role playings uncomfortable for you?
What would make it feel? Well, if, you know, the people from my professional world see too much of myself in my social world, they start to say, this guy who is so pretty proper over here, he's a little bit down, he's an imposter.
He's not me. He's just being
So, all right, so what you're pointing to is if living on those multiple realities proves itself to appear like inconsistencies to people, that I'm being hypocritical, or that I'm two-faced, or that I'm this way here, but I'm really somebody quite different over there. That's one reason why living those many different realities can be uncomfortable. What's another reason why it might be uncomfortable? So, being yourself in all of those different roles is what you're aiming for, if I understand. Okay. Well, here's one thing that these different examples from physics might provide by way of a resource to achieve that. Each of those realities has its own integrity. The reality of a beam of light functioning as a particle has its own integrity. That same beam of light acting as a wave function has its own reality, its own integrity, and it's just as valid. Sometimes we put ourselves in this arbitrary dilemma of having to choose either or. either I'm going to be this or I'm going to be that. What if, for a change, we decided to accept this multiple reality environment and listen to someone else with this starting place, that their reality is just as valid as mine? What? How might that change the dynamic in a relationship? If I go into a situation, accept it as part of my view of reality, that I might not see things the way this person does, but from that person's perspective, the reality is absolutely crystal clear. And yet from my perspective, it's so vastly different. How would that ability to shift the perspective alter the dynamic in relationship? Maybe there would be an opportunity there for a reconciling that would not be allowed if it's only one or the other. Now this gets very difficult because we love to be ensconced in our sense of what is right and true and real.
Well, I think if you're non-judgmental, you let go of that. You completely let go. I mean, I tend to socialize with different types of people, and obviously there are people that make sometimes disagreements about the reality of perception of things, you know, daily things, faces, and habits of our lives. However, at the end, when you let go of that judgmental part, whether you think you're right or wrong, you take it in the kind of...
Well, alright, so here's the question. By the way, what's your name?
Freedom. Freedom.
Freedom. What a beautiful name. Gosh. Freedom, there's often talk, even in yoga classes toward the end when we come to Savasana, of, you know, breathe in and say to yourself, let, and breathe out and say, go. So there's a kind of a favoritism toward just what you're describing of letting go. And yet we don't seem to be able to do it all the time. So what is it that keeps us from being able to do that? That's what I'm trying to...
Fear.
Huh? Fear of what?
Well...
Fear of what?
Fear of being alone, and fear of the unknown, and fear of that what you really want isn't valid. Mm. You and I talk all the time. So the biggest challenge is, the biggest fear is, as you start your path, and you go deeper into your path, do, sad to say, lose friends, in the sense that you think you no longer want to be putting on multiple hats. You want to start being your true self as you practice your physical asana yoga, as you chant, as you go to dharma classes, as you go to temples, as you, whatever it is, as you get deeper and deeper into your practice, the layers that you walk around with on this person in this group and this person in this group and this way and this work and this way and your family starts to not interest you anymore. You start to want to be this one person in all these realities. And there are people out there that don't accept it, and you start to shed those layers, and it's lonely, and you're afraid of tough. And it's a natural process, which is why you don't want, you have no more.
Now, most of you have been coming to these sessions long enough to be able to tell me what is that one reality, that one person, that one identity that you can have through all of these different changing roles that we play, all these different realities that we have to accommodate somehow. What is the one place that you can live in that will allow you to do that? The observer. Okay. What's another word for observer?
I haven't experienced my true self while consciously yet, so I can't tell you exactly.
No, that's one of the words that's used in the Gita. What are some other words to describe the observer?
The Atma.
The core self.
Third eye.
The third eye, which is a channel to perceive that inner self. Well, who is it that's loving?
Krishna.
Or who is it who wants to hate? I mean, the point is, you're coming in late, so the discussion is about multiple realities and how we can live with mystery. And sometimes that mystery is not love. Sometimes that mystery is a very, very uncomfortable reality that is just as valid from another person's perspective as ours is looking at it and saying, this is completely wrong.
I don't know, the word compassion comes into my mind discussing this. Compassion could all be about the multiple realities of us and others, but compassion to ourselves is said to
Krishna consciousness.
Krishna consciousness would be the Vaishnava way of describing having a sense of oneself in relationship to others. Because why? What when you say Krishna consciousness, what do you describe?
Krishna consciousness is where all interaction is related to Krishna. All beings have a part of Krishna in them. I'm saying they're all Krishna.
Ah.
But they all have a part of Krishna in them, and how you interact the world is for one purpose only, and it's to go to love Krishna. That's so, in relationships, that's within work, that's within your yoga. Mm-hmm. When you practice asanas in front of yoga studio, it's all devotional. Mm-hmm. And that's when you live one reality. That's why I like Ramana Swami. Wherever he goes, he's the same guy. I don't think you Ramana Swami outside of his parents. I think he's still Ramana Swami.
Well, I mean, because I've got a little bit of an inside track there, I can tell you that when he goes to visit his dad, for example, he doesn't sit down and give a Dharma talk for 2 hours.
No, but he's still Ramana Swami. He's still...
No, he's not. He's Richard Slater.
He's Richard Slater.
Yeah.
So he puts on jeans in the future?
Sometimes. Now, I don't know whether I'm supposed to tell you that, but, you know, because his father wants to take him someplace to be with family, and sometimes it's not always comfortable for family to see you in that way, he has the ability to make that change without missing a beat.
Because it's seva, because you're devotional still to Krishna by honoring your family.
So, what does that tell us? That's a good example. It tells us that you don't, that it's not hypocritical necessarily to be, you know, a dirt. if you're also remaining aware of yourself on that deeper level, because then you can role play. This was like, you know, this weekend up in Saratoga Springs was the topic was the eros of yoga. We talked about sexual relations. I hope I don't appear like preoccupied with that. I know we've talked about it here too, but it just does come up quite a bit. Role playing is possible in relationships where the participants have a very strong sense of their inner self, because they'll know that by surrendering to this role playing, I'm not compromised. I'm not losing who I am. And then the compassion can come in. I can only be compassionate toward you if I don't feel threatened. I can only be compassionate toward you and loving toward you if my sense of self is absolutely solid. And if I see that same inner self dwelling in you, then it's possible. Then I can do that. Then I can embrace your reality as having as much substance and meaning and reason for being as my own. Otherwise, not. Otherwise, your interests and mine are going to be totally different, and we're going to fight. I'm going to see you as being hypocritical, and I'm going to disagree. So, those multiple realities are possible. If you read the ancient texts, there were warring factions here. You know, when the Kauravas and the Pandavas were battling it out at Kurukshetra, you know that at night, when the sun sets, according to Kshatriya war codes, you stop fighting. So they did. And what did they do? They had dinner together.
With each other? Or
yeah.
Like all sides.
Yeah. They sat down and had dinner. Now they knew that tomorrow we're going to be fighting to the death again. But spiritual culture predicated on this deepest of all realities, that I am something inviolable and so are you, is so beautiful, so extraordinary, that it means that even if you and I have differences to the point where we have to fight about those differences, it doesn't mean that we have to remain inimical always.
That happened in World War II, too. During Battle of the Bulge, when Castro and the paratroopers' easy company was surrounded by the Germans, Christmas Eve, they stopped fighting. They actually all got out of their trenches and sang Christmas carols, socialized.
Because there was an ability to recognize at that moment, we're scared, they're scared. It's Christmas. Can we set our weapons down just for a little while and just be human beings again? That's why that event is so famous. Because it points to the possibility of compassion even in battle. Which is an amazing thing. It's a little hard to get your arms around that. You know, the idea is you can actually fight with compassion. It is possible. Yeah.
But for anyone to be a person who can see his work, or who can root himself, it's very difficult, right? Because we all have doubts, we have insecurities, and sooner or later we all slip. It's like, yes, some days we feel, yes, we know our work, but it's not. I mean, that case for my case, it's not common. There are days when I stable, days on chain.
Did everyone hear what Jaideep was saying?
No.
That we can know this, I'm paraphrasing, we can understand this intellectually, that we have this inviolable inner self. But we're filled with insecurities, we still make mistakes, we drop the ball, we fall down, and that's also a reality. Well said. We should never underestimate how deep our conditioning goes. I remember Prabhupada saying one time, as soon as you think you've started to advance in Krishna consciousness, that's when you're in trouble. Spiritual progress is not a cheap thing. It really takes immense practice and sincere, steady dedication to your practice. And little by little, it can be done. There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that's so beautiful. Krishna tells Arjuna Arjuna is telling Krishna, I can't do this. You're asking me to control my mind. You're asking me to embrace a dharma that I feel totally incapable of embracing. I can't do this. And Krishna says to him, yes, you can. You can do this by accepting an appropriate practice and persevering with that practice by steady determination. Now, what that means is that not everyone's practice is going to be the same. I can no more insist upon you chanting on these beads every day, as we did at the start of the class today, than I can, you know, insist that you accept that God is a little blue cowherd boy who plays a flute. But what I can tell you is that there is a practice that is appropriate for you, and your job is to find it. And when you found it, as Rodney is always reminding us, stick to that practice every day. Don't let go of that. That's your lifeline. And that will gradually, step by step, bring you to a place where you will find naturally, without having to force it, without forcing it, this is very important, don't force anything. You will find that you are capable of greater compassion, distancing yourself from unhealthy habits or mindsets, And that even insurmountable objects, insurmountable problems, insurmountable hurdles, somehow our vision of them changes. So it's not that they disappear or magically go away, but with that constant practice comes an ability to assess the circumstances around us with a much deeper sense of insight. It's an amazing thing. I know. I've seen it so many times. What may have seen, I've seen it in my own family when my son and his wife had their little girl. I mean, you know, for that was the wall for me. That was my Armageddon. You know, that was when my granddaughter was born. I thought, okay, my whole very carefully built house of cards of Krishna consciousness, somebody just pulled the card out from the middle on the bottom row and the whole thing's collapsed. Because when my granddaughter was born and had all these problems, all of a sudden it's like, what the hell? Why have I been chanting all these years? What's going on here? What's this? What's this one? Not this. Not this. Anything but this. You know, you want to hit me with something else, Krishna, fine, but not this. Not this. And it just seems to be maybe a rule of thumb in spiritual life that whatever you're most afraid of is the very thing that's going to rear its head and slap you in the face time and time and time and time again until you've learned to embrace it, until you've learned to look at it from this other angle, which is born of regular daily practice, and see it in such a way that you can actually embrace it and understand that you don't have to be afraid of it. You can get on with your life. You do not have to stay in this little realm of fear, insecurity, and indecision. It is possible to move on. Now, whether you want to accept that that's Krishna really in your heart dictating to you what to do, or just maybe getting smarter in your life, that's up to you. And the way the Gita says it is, I'm in your heart. I'm offering this. I'm offering this information. It's there for you if you turn to it. Okay. Yes. Yes, Rod.
I would say if you're looking for a road, you've got all the spirituality, which you may be or maybe not be, but if you want to balance it out, the spirituality actually, even if you don't know, if you don't feel, is your highest thought. That is the one that's going to go straight ahead. You'll be changeless. Once you keep that as the tool of whole mind and body, it's one thought to your goal. And then what will happen is when you go with that thought with the goal, eventually you will become unattached because the goal is still attachment. You've got to be attached to the goal to be free. Because it's your highest thought. That's the only way that we know. So you work to that goal. Eventually when you achieve the goal, you're not attached to the goal. What you are is where that look. That you were projected earlier because you had to find yourself. So the tool and the secret is go with that highest thought, and that will always keep you flowing because it's the energy of the lifeline, of the force of the love inside. Eventually, with that, you will become free because when you reach that goal with your highest thought, there's no goal. Your highest thought actually being spiritual comes from the love underneath.
You?
And then it becomes who you are. You don't have no more goals. You don't have no more thought because you're on a level beyond.
Thank you. Lovely. That's a lovely thing.
Thanks.
Good journey. So, you kind of excuse me, I have a bit of a cold today. So I think rather than using all the time, what I might do is invite you to maybe chat. Have a few minutes, just chat among yourselves. And unless there's something else someone would like to say.
I can't wait.
No, it's fine.
Oh, well. We have it for sale.
Oh, my God. I usually hate biology. Because it's really about the way the self-revelation.
Yes, he was an extraordinary fellow. Extraordinary fellow. There's someone who did what we've been talking about. He managed to embrace multiple realities. He was the first one I've ever met in my life. I was 19 when I first met him. He was the first person I ever knew who had the ability to acknowledge that faith and belief can be expressed in many, many different ways, and they're all really equal. It took me long time to come to that place. You know, because in the beginning of your spiritual life, there's a tendency to be a little fanatical. You know, it's my way or the highway sort of thing. And really, the only way to see things is the way I see it. George knew better than that. He was a really beautiful fellow.
I was in YouTube looking for the videos of him.
Yeah, maybe if you want. I have a very rarely broadcast interview. It's the last taped interview with George Harrison and Ravi Shankar. And if you're interested, would you like to see that? It runs about 15
yes.
or 20 minutes. They talk about spiritual sound. They talk about the soul. I mean, George is really quite candid. And this was just about 3 years before he passed away. So if you'd like, I'll bring that.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah?
Okay. Thank you for
the
Chapa beads. We have Chapa beads also.
Kim came back.
I'm sorry,
Kim told him. No, it's fine. Kim came back from India and she brought
$5 contribution.
You'd be great at a baseball game.
Kim's like,
well, I'll take one. I'll take one to go with me.
$5.
All right. So anything else? Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you. Yes.
Actually, you were just mentioning about sometimes when you hold that life in a few certain